On this podcast, we share a lot of stories, and often the mental health aspect of the work we do creeps in. If you think you might be feeling depressed, stressed, anxious, or even overwhelmed, please consider visiting our sponsor, BetterHelp. BetterHelp offers licensed therapists who are trained to listen and help you. And they even have therapists who specifically work with first responders. You just fill out a questionnaire to help assess your specific needs, and then you get matched with a therapist in under 48 hours. You can talk to your therapist in a private and online environment at your convenience. Many first responders work rotating and often odd schedules, so this format makes it really easy to talk to someone when it's convenient for you. If you don't click with your therapist, you can request a new one at no additional charge anytime. Join the 3 million plus people who have taken charge of their mental health with an experienced BetterHelp therapist. Get 10% off your first month at betterhelp.com/Rhody. That's betterhelp.com/Rhody, R-O-A-D-I-E. You can also find the link in the show notes.
Scene at 2213 Gordon Road. I need a full assignment for a working residential fire.
Med 23, engine 21, 67, breathing
problem. Fire lift on the Bravo end of the gable.
Command medic 12, let's go ahead and get rehab set up.
If you put a couple of first responders together in a room, something interesting happens. Before too long, they'll begin sharing stories. They're not trying to one-up each other, they're simply finding common ground. I was fortunate enough to serve my community as a paramedic and a firefighter for over 25 years. As you can imagine, during that time, I acquired my fair share of stories about the incidents and the calls I was involved in. I thought I might write a book, but then I decided sharing these stories collectively in a podcast would give anyone listening an insider's view into the work that first responders do every single day. These are the stories of the men and women who courageously serve the public. Or as I like to call them, stories from the road. Welcome back to Stories from the Road. On the podcast today, I'm glad to share the mic with dispatcher Justine. Justine worked as a communications officer and supervisor with a large sheriff's department in Florida, and today she's going to provide her insight into the incredibly important work communication officers do. Justine, I'll turn the mic over to you and let you share your story from the road.
Hello. My name is Justine, and just a little bit on my background. I have 27 years of experience in dispatch. I started my career when I was 33 with two small children, 2 and 5. I was a dispatcher for about 4 years. Then I was a senior dispatcher and a CTO, communications training officer, for about 10. And then I went to supervising for about 13. I grew up in a first responder home. My mom was actually a cop for a while when I was growing up, and then we moved and she became a dispatcher at the same sheriff's office I'm at. She's worked in dispatch 30 years after that, and then my dad was a 35-year lieutenant paramedic. So I grew up in the fast-paced environment. I heard things that a kid probably shouldn't heard, but I was used to it when I started it. In my 27 years of experience, I've experienced just about every type of call there is, from several tragedies involving our own law enforcement deputies to even doing one of their last calls. Doing a last call, it's rewarding, but at the same time, it's gut-wrenching, knowing that when you're calling that unit on the radio, you know they're not going to answer you back. So it's gut wrenching. It's hard, but you got to do it. I've taken obviously a lot of other sad calls, but the things that really stick with you are those calls, especially pertaining to children. You never forget those. You do what you have to do, and you go on to the next call. I will tell you one I had that still haunts me to this day. Back in 2000, I had been a dispatcher probably for about 5 years. It was in July. It was very hot outside. We live in Florida, so it was probably a good 90, 95 degrees outside. And in 2000, you know, the cell phones weren't too popular. But the caller that called me, she had a cordless phone. and she was outside with her 9-month-old baby. And she was sitting in her car that wasn't running. She had no keys to it. She just sitting there with the door open. Obviously, it was too hot to shut the door and lock it. She called me and told me that her and her boyfriend were having a domestic. So I got units on the way, got a description of him. He was in the house. But during the time I was speaking to her, as she was holding her 9-month-old, he kept coming out and saying things to her, derogatory stuff. And I just told her, you know, just stay on the phone with me. Don't listen to him. Don't talk to him. Don't say anything to upset him even more. So he'd go back in the house, and he did that probably about 2 or 3 times, just egging her on and upsetting her. And then all of a sudden he came out. He was yelling, and I'd probably been on the phone with her probably a good 10 minutes, which those 10 minutes, it sounded like, seemed like it was 30 minutes, but it was only probably about 10 to 15 minutes, and deputies were, they're on the way. He comes out, he says something to her. I couldn't understand what exactly he said, and then I hear a gunshot. She starts crying, screaming. I hear the baby moaning, and I asked her what happened, and she's like, he just shot our baby in the head. So immediately I got her over to EMS dispatch. Just as I was transferring her, my deputies were rolling on scene. And of course I needed to know where he went for my deputy's safety. So, you know, trying to get that out of her with her screaming and crying, he had went back in the house. So the deputy pulled up knowing that the baby had been shot. So he got them in the back of his patrol car and backed away from the scene. And long story short, the suspect went inside and he killed himself. And the baby ended up passing away. But just hearing that baby moaning and groaning, and you just know that it's not going to be good. And that just stuck with me. And so I got off the call. I put my phone in not ready status, which on our dispatch panel just means that you not ready means that you can't take another call. Another call won't automatically drop until you go ready. So I sat there for a second trying to like go through what I just went through. And I was like sitting there trying to think, did I do something wrong? Was it my fault that this baby's dead? I kept her on the phone. Maybe if I let her hang up, she could walk down the street and call me. You know, I was just going through all these emotions. So I logged off my phone. I got up, and then it hit me. I went in the back room where our lockers were, and I just started crying. And the manager at the time asked me what I was doing. I explained the call to him, and he's like, well, you need to dry it up and get back out there on the phones. We're busy. And I just looked at him and I'm like, you know what? No, I can't. I'm going home. I'm going home. And so I logged off. I got my stuff and I went home. And when I got home, I literally just hit my knees and prayed to God, like, you know, prayed for the mother, prayed for the family, prayed that it wasn't my fault. And I just went through all these emotions and it was very tough. To this day, if I hear the call, it's ironic. They use that call in our dispatch training to our new people that start. They play this call, and a lot of them, I know of like maybe 2 or 3 over the years that are in just start, and they hear this call and they're like, I can't do it. And they walk out of training and they never come back. You know, even not hearing that call, I think about it periodically. Yes, it was 22 years ago, but I remember it like it was yesterday. It's just something that you relive every now and then.
Yeah, Justine, that is just an incredible story. And there's so many things running through my head. And I think what stands out to me is that when these horrific incidents take place, the focus is placed on the first responders, the guys that are in the field that are dealing with the situation. And I think oftentimes dispatchers are overlooked. And while, you know, for you as a call taker, this call essentially ended, but had you not put your phone in not ready status, you could have taken another call that maybe was just as horrific right after this one. And there's just so little focus on the job that you guys do. And I think that really, you know, you don't get the credit that you deserve. And I think dispatchers in general and communications officers, you know, the call takers, the dispatchers are often overlooked, you know, simply because they're not out there on the front lines. But, you know, these things get pounded into you over and over again. And I imagine over the course of your career, you know, there's probably hundreds of calls that just, you know, maybe not as horrific as this one, but just didn't sit well with you, where you had to take a minute and had to collect yourself and then, you know, move on to something else.
Yeah. Actually, I took a case and it was never a call that it was never a case that was never solved. Is a little bit earlier than this call in 1997. It was a 5-month-old baby that went missing out of her crib during the night. And I'm like, 5-month-old kids don't walk or anything. So something happened to her. And it was early in the morning. Of course, the parents are screaming and crying. And they said something during the call, and It's a high profile case, so I don't want to say too much about it, but I knew right when, within the same minute I asked the question, but I reworded it and they answered different, I knew something was up. And to this day, they never found her. I have no doubt in my mind that they did something with her, whether it was an accident or.
It's kind of interesting that you say that you asked the same question twice and got two different answers. And I'm just curious, my own personal knowledge, are you guys trained? Because a lot of times, you know, if a detective is questioning somebody, they're Mirandized and, you know, they're very careful about what they say. But in those first few minutes when someone's on the phone with 911 and the dispatcher's asking certain questions, is there any training that you get to sort of get that initial information and maybe pick up on inconsistencies and stories that can then help the case later on?
Well, I started in 95. Back then, you just started and you didn't have no training. You just sat with a seasoned dispatcher, usually a senior. They didn't even have communications training officers then. And you just sat with a senior dispatcher and you sat with them for 6 months over their phones and the radios, and you just learn it. It was just, like I said, I grew up around my mom, and I sometimes went to work with her, you know, back then in the 70s and 80s, you could hang out and work with them. And, you know, I just learned stuff from her, and I've always been the nosy type of person anyways, and I ask questions. So they do now, they do the training and how to ask questions. And like I said, I asked it in one way, and then within 45 seconds, I asked it in another way, and the same person answered me a totally different way. And I'm like, wait a minute, you just told me, you know, this happened, but now you're telling me something else. So
definitely useful information that's gathered from a 911 call. So share some more calls. I know you probably have a bunch you can talk about.
Well, let's see. We get very strange calls, funny calls. There are some calls with a desperate voice on the other end. Suicidal calls can either go one way or one of two ways. They can be rewarding if you save the person, which I have actually done that and received a life-saving reward award for it. He was actually calling the operator to get his mom's number in another state so he could call and tell her goodbye because he was going to kill himself. So the operator had him on the phone and she had me in her other ear, and I guess she muted him, and she called me at the sheriff's office and told me that she had the caller and what he wanted and what he was going to do. So I told her to hang up with him and tell him that you're going to call him right back. You're looking for the number. So he hung up with her. And within probably a minute, I called him. I dialed his number and I told him my name. I told him I'm Justine. I said, yeah, I'm trying to find your mom's number. And I just started rebuilding a rapport with him. And I asked him, you know, why he wanted to kill himself, if he had plans, how he's going to kill himself. He definitely said he had a plan, and I asked him how, and he said he was going to shoot himself. I asked him if he had a gun, and he said yes. And then I asked him where the gun was, and he's like, to my head. Well, when he said that, I felt my whole blood pressure change. You know, like, I was thinking, okay, all right, he's got a gun to his head, Justine. You got to talk him out of this. And I did. It took me probably a good 20, 30 minutes. And my deputies were already on scene. But I told him to stand off until, you know, I could get him to the door. So I told him that I was going to knock on the door. And I did. I lied to him. But I saved a life at the same time. So I told him I was going to be at the door.
You can forgive the little white lie.
Yeah, right. I knocked on the door and I told him I was going to knock on the door. And I asked him, first of all, I asked him, could you put the gun down? Because I don't like guns. And he said, yes. So he laid it down on the table. And then I asked him if he could unload it. And he did that for me. And then I said, I'm fixing to knock on your door. Can you come to your door with your hands up, with everything except your phone in your hand? Nothing in your hand but your phone. And he said, yes. So that's when I told the deputies, go ahead and knock on the door. And told him that he was expecting me, but he's going to have the phone in his hand and that's it. And the gun is on the table by the chair, unloaded. And sure enough, when they knocked, he opened the door. And the gun was on the table, unloaded. So he did what I asked. So that was rewarding. But then again, there's the suicides that aren't so rewarding. I had one gentleman call late afternoon. It was like a few minutes before I got off shift. He called and he was in a park. And he said he was going to kill himself. We went by first names. I got that rapport going. He was just stressed about money, but he wanted me to call his sister and tell her goodbye for him. And he definitely had a gun, and he was sitting by a tree in the park. So, you know, obviously my deputies are there and they're standing by waiting. You know, this went probably a good 45 minutes, and he kept telling me, you know, I'm sorry, you know, you're the last person I'm going to talk to. Thank you for talking to me, listening to me. And I literally was almost on my knees and at my console begging him, please, you know, don't do this. There's other ways to handle things. And he said, I'm sorry. And then he hung up and he shot himself. And I'm not going to lie, kind of pissed me off that, you know, I just spent 45 minutes begging you to not do this and thought I was getting somewhere with you and it didn't do no good. So, you know, some calls, attempt suicides are good and some go through with it. They have a plan and then there's no stopping them.
Now, I know you said earlier that when you started, you really didn't have a whole lot of training. And I was wondering, dispatchers today, so maybe within the last 5 or 10 years, is there any kind of specialized training that dispatchers receive to deal with calls just like this one?
Dispatchers are now, in our state, they have to be certified to be a dispatcher. Then they have to keep that certification up every 2 years. They have to renew it. At our agency, we have a 6-week class now that they actually go through. They learn, obviously, all the basic stuff, the codes, the signal codes, the 10 codes. Obviously get ready for the exam because the exam, they have a state exam that they have to pass. So then they go to the floor and there's training. They sit with a CTO on the phones, probably about a good 2 months. And then they move over to radio. During that time, there are classes online that we can take if you have the time. Sometimes we'll pull them off. As a supervisor, we'll pull the dispatcher or the call taker off the floor and tell them, hey, go back in the room and, you know, do this class. And some of them are mandatory and they have to keep up their certification. They have to have so many hours a year. So we have to make sure that they do get the training. So yes, there is a lot more training now than there was back in the 90s.
So let's shift gears a little. Let's lighten some things up.
Okay.
I'm sure sitting on the receiving end of the phone or even the radio, you know, some of the calls that come in kind of make you shake your head and you think, you know, what's happening here? Or, you know, what did I just listen to? Maybe you can share some of those calls with the folks that are listening to this.
I got a 911 call and it was freaking early in the morning. And all I hear is this guy just, all he says is, I said, you know, 911, what is your emergency? He's like, please don't laugh. And I'm like, okay, sir, what is your emergency? And he just kept saying, please don't laugh. You're going to laugh. And I'm like, sir, this is 911. What is your emergency? If you need help, let me know. Otherwise, we're going to hang up. And this went on for a good minute or so. And he kept saying, please don't laugh. And I'm like, sir, I'm not going to laugh. I said, you need to tell me what's going on. And he's like, well, I'm bleeding profusely from my rear end. And I was like, okay. So I just hit that button, got him over to EMS. And of course, inquiring minds want to know. I stayed on the line listening. And he told, finally, they got around asking him why he was bleeding. And he said he had stuck a glass dildo up his rear and it broke and it cut him. So, you know, I had to sit here and listen to this and, well, I didn't have to, but I did. And EMS telling him to get a wash rag and apply pressure. And of course, you know, the whole comm center came over and pushed my replay button listening to it. So,
well, I'm glad as a paramedic, I didn't have to respond to that one. What were some of the things that were really frustrating to you as a communications officer?
Oh, there's so many things. Like, a dispatcher can handle hundreds of situations effortlessly every day, yet there may be one that triggers you. Even in that one moment when you get that one call that gets under your skin, you have to keep on. You have to keep carrying on. You can't disconnect. You know, and there's just something about being a dispatcher that makes you passionate about this job, and you keep doing it. We take, like I said, we take strange calls, we take funny calls, suicidal calls, hearing gunshots over the phone, that's so frustrating because, like I said, you know, you beg them not to do it and it doesn't work. They do it anyway. You know, the stress experienced by 911 dispatchers is what develops with listening to someone else's absolute worst day every day. We listen to it every day because people don't call 911 when they're having a good day. Although sometimes they just call to say hi, believe it or not.
No, I believe it. And, you know, I've always thought of dispatchers as the folks who really took care of us when we were in the field, you know, the lifeline, if you will. And whether that's updating information while responding to an ambulance call, a fire, a shooting, or just, you know, those times when things went really bad really quickly. You know, I always appreciated knowing that when I asked for help over the radio, there was someone there that was going to listen and there was someone that was going to send that help right now. And it's something that always stood out to me about how important that relationship is between the folks that are in the field and the communications officers at the console, you know, knowing that, you know, you're really all we have, whether it's a mayday, whether it's, you know, right. I'm getting my head beat in by somebody, you know, I can yell help all I want until I put it over the radio. I'm not going to get that help. And that's something that always stood out to me about, you know, the work that you guys did.
Take, for example, one night when I was on midnights, it was kind of quiet. And then all of a sudden this radio keys up on the radio and all we can see is what we call their LID number. And we run it and the officer, he's not even logged on. So we're like, but it sounded like a struggle. So luckily we were able to GPS his radio and get to him in the area. And he was actually struggling with someone on the ground and he didn't have time to say anything on the radio. He was just able to push his radio button. So just being aware of what you hear over the radio, just as a call taker, sometimes, take for instance, we get a 911 call and it's a domestic, but they're not talking, but you can tell it's a domestic in the background. That's when the dispatcher has to listen to hear exactly what is going on, what you hear. You need to put that in the call so the officers know before they get there what they're going to. Although domestics, they're all different, and domestics probably one of the worst calls we could respond to. Because, you know, when they call, there's a range of emotion, and most of it's anger. But a lot of times they dial 911 and they won't talk to us. And we have to get their address either by GPS, or if it was a landline, we have their address. And then we have to listen. One, we have to listen. Is there any kids in the background? Any mentions of weapons, knives, guns, whatever. And anything that remotely like sounds like a weapon, like, you know, being cocked or whatever. You just have to listen to these things and update the call so we can let the officers know what they are responding to, even though this person's not talking to us, but we know what we hear. Things are being broken. Are they physically fighting? So they know what they're going into when they knock on that door.
You know, Justine, I talked to a lot of first responders on the podcast, but in a way, you guys are actually the front line of the first responders, or I think as you called it once before when we talked, you are the first responders. And I wonder if you can talk about some of the work that you're doing to be recognized.
Yeah. 911 dispatchers can suffer vicarious trauma, also known as compassion fatigue. As a result, you know, from years of helping callers and deputies and officers who experienced the worst day of their lives, answering the phone and hearing gunfire, beatings, or sometimes just like I was talking about, the silence or crying. A dispatcher, to me, that makes a dispatcher the first responder. We're hearing the first everything. Dispatchers hear callers take their last breaths. And then we often hear a baby's first cry. So I look at us as a first responder. The law doesn't look at us this way yet. It has changed in some of the states, and we're hoping that Florida gets there soon so that, you know, we can also get first responder, what do you call it?
Hazard pay.
Yeah, hazard pay. I guess it is pay.
It is.
Hazard pay. Because we experience, even though we're not physically there, everything is happening in our ear, in our head. And just like the call that I took, it sticks with you. And that can lead to PTSD. I mean, that can lead to a lot of different things. And luckily, I know how to deal with it, and I help other people deal with it as I'm on the peer support team with our agency and the regional critical incident team. I've been on that team for 22 years. So I kind of know how to deal with it, but you know, just a lot of your everyday dispatchers that are new, they don't know how to deal with it. So, you know, that's what we're here for, to help them deal with it.
And I would imagine you feel a certain level of responsibility for the people that you are sending into dangerous situations, and the things that they encounter affect you probably as much as they affect them.
They do. Our agencies had a lot of impacts, as far as like we've even had an officer come on the radio and actually kill his family members and himself over the radio. And the first, I was a supervisor then, and I wasn't even on the floor when this was happening, but I came out of my office and I heard what was happening. And the first thing we had to do was, as soon as we could, is get that radio dispatcher out of the room and go talk to him and make sure he was, you know, obviously he's not doing all right, but we just need to make sure that he was good if he needed to leave or, you know, needed to go talk to somebody. And we actually now have a psychologist that works for the sheriff's office and is strictly for the employees. If you're in a traumatic situation and you need to talk to somebody now, you can call her or go see her.
Yeah, that's certainly something that I would imagine is needed. And I believe that, you know, even with your experience, you know, you can share that with other dispatchers, with newer dispatchers, mm-hmm. and really help them through difficult situations just from being a peer counselor, if you will.
Right. When I got on the critical incident team back in 2001, so it's been 21 years, just a real quick rundown, critical stress management, we call it CISM, is a structured group. It's a process facilitated by a group of peers, rather it be our team consists of all kinds of peers, dispatch, fire dispatch, EMS dispatch, surrounding agencies around our county, different counties, law enforcement. We have mental health, and we have clinical directors also. And they actually are given an opportunity, the people that experience the trauma, we give them an opportunity to talk about and react to the incident, and then we teach them how to recover from the incident. So we do that either by one-on-ones, diffusions, debriefings, but we're there for them and we're utilized often. So where I was going is dispatch was always left out of the critical incident because once again, you know, we weren't the first responder. And then it's grown over the years, over the last, I would say the good last 5 to 7 years, they realized that we are the first responders and that we also need help. So I make it a point in our dispatch center to, if I hear somebody taking a rough call, I go straight over them, tell them to log off, and let's go take a walk.
Well, Justine, as we wrap this up, any last words you want to share? Any last bit of information that you think that anybody listening to this podcast should hear?
I know you guys are out on the field, on the road. You're awesome. But I think our dispatch is super awesome. And it takes a very special person to be a dispatcher. And I just want to thank them all for all their hard work. And y'all keep up the good work.
Well, I want to personally thank you for the work that you did over 27 years and the work that you do now to support other dispatchers. And thank you for coming on the podcast and sharing a little insight into what goes on behind the radio console. I think it's an area of...
Oh, you're welcome.
It's probably an area that we overlook, and I think that's unfortunate. But, you know, I know there are many times that I was grateful to have someone on the other end of the radio, and I think a lot of folks that listen to this podcast and a lot of folks that are working as first responders today are grateful to know that when they key up that microphone, you know, there's a professional at the other end of that mic that's going to get them what they need. And that's incredibly important.
Yes.
I hope you'll come back and, you know, maybe share some fun stories with us and some things, kind of go through your Rolodex, if you will, and pull out some calls over 27 years. And I think it's really interesting, and I'm sure the listeners would love to hear more from you. But thank you for taking some time today to share the story.
Oh, you're welcome. Thank you for having me.
If you enjoyed this podcast, please take a minute and give us a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts or whichever podcast platform you're listening on. Stories from the Road is a Brown Dogs Media Group production. This one-man show is written, edited, and produced by Phil Klein. If you have a story you would like to share, please contact us at storiesfromtheroadpodcast@gmail.com. To learn more about this or other podcasts we're producing, please visit browndogsmedia.com. Thank you for listening.